We've been talking about the benefits of getting angry and about using it to spark some change. Well, neuroscientist Richard Davidson has a different take.
It's not as useful as we may think.
Davidson founded and runs the Center for Healthy Minds at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's a global leader on the subject of emotional well-being. He's also a friend and confidant of the Dalai Lama, and he told Steve Paulson that he has come to believe that anger is fundamentally destructive.
I think that particularly in today's climate, where there is a gaping lack of civility, anger exacerbates that. I certainly understand why victimized groups become angry. It's not unreasonable for them to become angry. But the question is whether it is skillful in helping to actually resolve the situation and improve it.
Let me turn this more personally to your own history, because I've heard you talk about back in the 60s and 70s when you were a political activist. You were out there marching against the Vietnam War, and it's hard to imagine protests against something like that that are not motivated, not born out of anger in some
way.
Well,
I was definitely angry in those days, no question about it. So, absolutely. And I think that they're probably, in hindsight, there might have been more skillful ways of protesting. There's a kind of moral outrage, if you will, or moral indignation, which can occur without all of the accompaniments of anger. We see beautiful examples of that in extraordinary leaders, such as Martin Luther King, Gandhi, Nelson Mandela. In the contemporary world, I had the honor of spending some time about a year ago with John Lewis, the African-American congressman from Georgia, who was part of the civil rights movement in the 60s. And John was imprisoned for more than 6 months for going into an all-white bathroom in Alabama.
And beaten badly and beaten in the March on Selma.
Yes. John Lewis has zero anger. I mean, absolutely none. Not in any morsel of his body.
But was he angry back then? Is that partly what motivated him to be able to do all of that?
I don't know. I can't really answer that. But I can tell you today, he is filled with love. And he's still a member of the U.S. Congress. And that can't be an easy job these days.
Hmm. When you say he's filled with love, how did you see that?
You can feel it. You can feel that even for his ideologically opposite adversaries in the United States Congress, he can see their humanity as people, and he can love them as a human being while strongly disagreeing with them, but it's not anger. And I think that the way he responds is so different because of that. Now, that takes work. You know, you can't just tell a person, give up anger and fill yourself with love. That's not going to work. It's highly impractical.
Does it work if only one side shows compassion and the other side remains angry?
It's got to start somewhere. So one side needs to be courageous.
So to go back to your own experience then, protesting against the Vietnam War, I mean, you said you were really angry back then, but it sounds like you're saying that if you could do it over again, you would have done it differently?
Yes, I would have done it differently. And I was definitely an angrier person then. I was, you know, not just angry about the Vietnam War. I was more volatile in my daily life. You know, not that I was ever an excessively angry person, but I definitely lost it at work, you know, a few times a week. That just, you know, that doesn't happen anymore.
Hmm.
It was a gradual change that took decades.
And you've had a decades-long practice of meditation, I know.
Yes. You know, I certainly attribute my practice to being a big part of this.
This is something that I struggle with as I think about it. I mean, a movement like the protest against the Vietnam War, I mean, how could that movement take shape? How could it mobilize people without anger sort of driving people to do that? What you might call justified anger.
Well, you know, screaming at your enemy is just, it's not going to lead to very much productive change. While it is righteous anger in some sense, and certainly completely understandable, it's just not clear to me what beneficial impact that's going to have other than to perhaps give the person who's expressing the anger some sense of satisfaction at having unleashed and let off some steam about this. I mean, when we are on the other side of the receiving end of it, it certainly doesn't feel good.
Right.
It leads to a kind of defensive posture.
Speaking of your own personal history, I know you have spent a lot of time, a lot of years, working with Tibetan Buddhists, and you've gotten to know the Dalai Lama quite well. If there's anyone who has a right to be angry, it's the Dalai Lama. I mean, forced out of his native Tibet, demonized by the Chinese authorities, his country has been taken away. Is he angry?
Not about that. I've never seen him angry about the Tibet situation.
Really?
I've seen him very sad. I've seen him cry on many occasions. I have seen him angry a few times, very rarely, but I've seen him get angry for a very short period of time.
What, like a few minutes?
No, a few seconds. I mean, but there was real anger there for a few seconds. Huh. I've seen him, you know, just flare very transiently. And then what's so unusual about the Dalai Lama is that in one particular episode that I have a very clear memory of, he became angry because someone did something that was not appropriate. And then just literally a couple of seconds later, he noticed on the person who committed this action that he clearly disapproved of, he noticed something funny about what they were wearing, and he just burst out laughing.
So basically, he obviously recognizes that he's angry, but he's immediately able to control it.
Well, I would say that it's not control in that case. It's purely spontaneously being in the moment. So it's not that he's suppressing the anger. The anger arises, and then it naturally dissipates, and then he's in the next moment. There's no spillover from one moment to the next.
Are you surprised that he's not angry about what China has done to Tibet?
No. No, I'm not surprised. One of the stories that he likes to tell is about a Tibetan monk who is imprisoned in a Chinese jail and escaped after some period of time and came over the border, and the Dalai Lama interviewed him and asked him, was there any point during your imprisonment when you were afraid? And this monk said, yeah, there were a couple of times when I really was afraid. I was afraid when I was beginning to lose my compassion for my captors.
I mean, these seem like superhuman people who can respond to a situation like that.
I mean, what's amazing is that they're really not. They're very ordinary in many ways. However, there are two things. One is they've been living in a culture from birth where these values are imbued. And the second is that they practice training their mind starting early in childhood.
Hmm. Let me ask you about an interview that we heard earlier in the show. We talked with Rebecca Traister, who's just written a book about women's anger, and she has a very different take. She says that women constantly get the message that their anger is ugly or shameful, so they bottle it up, and it often leads to depression. And she realized that anger has value, and once she realized that, she felt better physically and emotionally. She slept better. She said she had better sex with her husband. She felt validated, and she felt relief and almost exhilaration at times. So her advice is, especially for women, to let it out, to feel it, to say it, to integrate it into your life. Does that make sense to you?
In part, yes. I think that it's very toxic to bottle up anger. So that if you're experiencing anger, trying to actively suppress it, I think, is very unhealthy. And there's a lot of evidence to suggest that. So I would say that her perspective on that is very consistent with scientific evidence. There are other ways to transform anger rather than bottling it.
How do you transform it?
Years of practice.
Practice, you mean you're talking about mindfulness kind
of
practice?
Well, awareness, compassion, training the mind to cultivate more virtuous qualities. I think it's possible to transform anger, but not by bottling it.
So love the person who is furious at you, if you can.
And in most cases, you can't. And so this is not a something you can simply tell a person. And I recognize that even the thought of this is so upsetting to some people, because there is a kind of righteous indignation with acts that are committed that are morally inappropriate. And so it's really important for this not to be misinterpreted. You can't just tell a person to love. If they don't have the mental wherewithal to love, you can't tell them to love. You have to create the causes and conditions that allow love to arise.
So one final question. This is really hard work to develop this compassion. I mean, not just as sort of an idea, but to really sort of take it in and, you know, to have this kind of love that you're talking about. How do you get there? What kind of practice can help you become that person?
I see this, Steve, as an urgent public health need. And this is really about caring for our mind. And even if we spend a few minutes every day intentionally caring for our mind in this way, by developing these positive qualities and doing it every day, year in, year out.
You're talking about meditation?
Yeah, different kinds of meditation to cultivate kindness, to cultivate gratitude, to cultivate compassion. The world would be a different place. You know, we've published data in a randomized controlled trial showing that as little as 7 total hours of practice across several weeks is sufficient to change the brain. And once people begin to taste the qualities that arise when you do this, I think they're going to want to do it more. And so I see us moving toward a tipping point. In the United States today, we've really done a good job in tremendously decreasing the percentage of people who smoke in the population as a public health campaign. I mean, if you go back to 1950 and compare it today, it's dramatic. We need to do the same thing for caring for our mind.
Thank you.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Neuroscientist Richard Davidson. He directs the Center for Healthy Minds at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's also the co-author with Dan Goleman of the book Altered Traits.